Cornucopia Radio presents.
Maybe I will have another cup of coffee.
That was Thought for the Day with Barry. And now we're pleased to announce that instead of your usual Cornucopia Radio scheduled programming, you will instead be linking up with us here at Radio 4 for the next hour. That's right, you're listening to Radio 4. It's okay now. You're safe. Coming up later today, we'll have a brand new series in which deceased cultural figures join Julian Warwicker for 18 holes and a chat. That's par for the corpse, this afternoon at a certain time. But before that, something a little more unusual. Unusual Lives. Do Life Differently. Episode 1. Brian Parker.
So how much is a goat, Brian? Where do you even get one from?
Well, to be honest, it's got much easier in the last 15 years. Before, it were a rate fat. You either had to find a farmer who were willing to sell you one, and farmers, right, they're a suspicious bunch, I'll tell you that for free. They take one look at you and just pass.
Do you think that was because of the robe?
Nah, I think you might be right. Or you'd have to rear one yourself. Which in a 1970s semi brings challenges of its own, I can tell you. Council do not like that, not one bit.
But it's easier now?
Just buy them on internet, don't you? Which is where I got Charlie here from.
And the fact that it's a goat, not say a sheep or a pig, is that significant? Is there tradition behind that?
Sure. Some people say that goat is a potent symbol of masculine virility and that he is a powerful spirit. Others point out your ram is much dearer and you've got to take that into consideration. I mean, we're doing this 3-4 times a year. It adds up, you know. I've already had to cut back on my organic vegetables, haven't I?
Because you're a vegetarian, aren't you, Brian?
True. I only eat meat from Waitrose. Settle down, Charlie. He's a bit excitable at the moment.
Yes, well, the shotgun is a bit unnerving, Brian.
What, old Sally Two Barrels? No, she ain't loaded. Don't you worry, pal. Won't want any harm to come to Charlie here. Well, not before everything's ready, anyway.
And when is that again? Could you just point that away from me, please?
You big puff. Week of Tuesday. Got to wait for moon. And forecast says rain for the next few days, so...
Is that significant?
What, the rain?
Yeah.
No, just a faff, isn't it? Got to put your waterproof or robe. Wellies and whatnot.
And you are sure that isn't loaded?
Of course I'm sure. Luke, I'll show thee. Come here, Charlie. Oh, balls.
Not anymore, he hasn't. Is that going to be a problem?
Well, it is going to make the soup a bit tricky. Hang on. I've got some mistletoe back here somewhere. That'll patch him right up.
I don't think he's such a potent symbol of masculine virility anymore, Brian.
No, I think you might be right. Do you think I can send him back?
Sorry?
You know, for a refund, like.
I think you might have damaged the goods, Brian.
Aye. Oh, well. Back to the drawing board. Come here, Charlie. Fancy a goat burger, pal?
Brian Parker is a druid. He is 49 years old and lives in Tinsley, Sheffield. As well as fulfilling his duties as High Seer of the Light for the Tinsley Circle of Druids and Wood Dwellers, he also works at a local call centre, dealing with customer complaints for a well-known internet service provider. I followed Brian for a week last February as he went about his daily activities, both pagan and modern, and made preparations for a trip he would describe to me only as his holiday. Over the last decade, Druidism has seen a rise in popularity, with official figures from the 2011 census putting the national total at 5, possibly even 6 Druids, up from a total of 1.3 in the 1990s, a rise of 390%. I talked to Brian about modern Druidism in the UK. Brian, you're a member of the British Society of Druids and Warlocks, aren't you?
I certainly am. Here's my membership card. 000002.
And how many members are there?
5. There's me, Magic Bob, Sally, and a chap called Derek, though we don't see him very often. Between you and me, he's a bit weird.
Thanks for the Batwing tea, by the way, Brian. It's interesting. But you, Sally, Derek and Magic Bob, that's only 4, isn't it?
True. There's also Wilfred, though he is a Labrador.
And do dogs count?
They do. Especially if you fill out a census form for him.
Presumably they can't hold the pens.
Aye.
And how can Wilfred be a druid, given that he's a dog?
2 reasons. 1, he's the transmigrated spirit of Wilfred Farseer, a great warlock and president of the Tinsley Circle for 40 years or more, before he met his end one day when he fell downstairs and into a dog. And 2, at the time, we were trying to get our membership numbers up so we'd qualify for Booper's group discount.
I thought you didn't believe in modern medicine.
We don't. Unless it really hurts.
Like
standing on a plug. No amount of mistletoe's going to solve that, is it?
No, fair enough. I asked Brian why he practiced such an unusual lifestyle and how he'd been drawn to druidism in the first place.
About 10 years ago, I had an epiphany. I were working at call centre one evening and I'd just finished explaining to some tosspot from Surrey that, no, he couldn't speak to me supervisor because Barry, right, he runt shitter at time, and I thought to myself, Brian, is this it? Are you really going to spend the rest of your days picking up phone till they lay you in grave? Or are you going to embrace something real, something bigger than yourself, you know? So I tore up my Labour Party membership card and found something I could believe in. I've never looked back. Because that sort of behaviour will turn you into a pillar of salt, won't it?
And what is it that being a druid gives you that other lifestyles don't?
Well, we all have ways of coping with modern world, don't we? Some people drink and some smoke and others eat too much. I even know one guy, right, who hands over cash every month so he can go to this special room where a woman in tight lycra shouts at him and he has to do whatever she says.
What, like sexual things?
No, you pervert. Like running on moving floor, lifting heavy weights and sweating in front of complete strangers. Stuff like that, you know. I mean, I think that's weird. For my part, I stone pigeons while chanting and wearing me robe. And now that I've learnt playgrounds aren't an appropriate place to do that, it's all to good, ain't it?
And how do you balance? I mean, it must be difficult to balance your work with your duties at the call centre.
It can be tricky, yeah. I tried to keep them separate. I learnt that the hard way at my last job, which weren't so, shall we say, respectable.
Thank you for calling South Yorkshire Singles, Sexy Chat for Unemployed Minors. Please note, you must be under 16 to use this service. Your call is important to us. Please wait while we sacrifice a cow to Odin, so that he may help us deal effectively with your call. This call may be recorded for training and quality purposes, and so that we may steal your soul.
And you're going on holiday, aren't you, Brian?
True, that I am.
And where is it that you're going?
Somewhere new.
like Lancashire?
Lancashire ain't no joke, pal. I put 1 foot wrong side at Pennines and some wanker will shoot me with a longbow and no mistake.
I didn't realise there was such territorial animosity amongst druids.
Who said druids? No, I'm going somewhere new. You've got to expand your horizons, haven't you?
And how long are you going for? When are you coming back?
Who says I'm coming back? Might like it there. Maybe I'll find a new life, away from call centre, away from me past.
Wouldn't you miss Tinsley?
You listen here, pal. I bloody am Tinsley. Where I go, Tinsley goes. End of. Miss Tinsley. I ain't no queer, am I? Just because I'm wearing purple robe don't make me a fancy man, does it? I ain't fucking Pope, pal.
All right, Brian, calm down.
Miss Tinsley. Next you'll be saying I've been interfering with goats. Which I ain't. Say it.
Sorry, I don't understand.
Say I ain't been interfering with no goats, and you didn't see what you thought you saw.
No, you haven't. You haven't been interfering with any goats. The scout's on. I asked Brian about modern druidism and what it meant to him.
People think it's all beards and robes, like a Liberal Democrat conference, you know. But it ain't. There's sickles as well. And there's some high-profile druids too. People in public eye like. But I shouldn't really say.
Oh, go on. Just one.
Well, all right then. That's Steve Jobs. He's one.
Steve Jobs?
Aye.
So I'm the former Apple CEO Steve Jobs, who's now dead.
Well, is he though?
He is.
Yeah, no, you're right. I remember now. It were in paper, weren't it?
Well, it was in all the papers, I think, wasn't it, Brian?
Yeah, but it were in the paper. A Daily Sacrifice. News, views and boobs for the modern druid. Do you want to see a copy? Look, today we've got 10 uses for goat testicles. That might come in quite handy, actually. A double page spread on naughty witches.
Is that the boobs bit?
No. They're a coven over Rotherham way, aren't they? Lovely ladies. Excellent salamander jam. Boobs is... Yep. Look at that pair. Magic. That's what they are. Not literally, obviously.
Is there anything else in today's edition, Brian?
No, special. Just interview with George Osborne.
I'm sorry, you're saying George Osborne is a druid?
Yeah.
George Chancellor of the Exchequer Osborne is a druid?
Oh, no. Sorry, my mistake. He's more of a warlock, really. He practices, well, let's just say he's gone astray a bit, you know. Dabbles with darker stuff. Quantitative easing, deficit reduction, that kind of thing. It's frowned upon. I won't touch it, Miss N. Besides, it's all locus pocus voodoo nonsense, ain't it? What you need to fix economy is...
Is it a goat, Brian?
Yeah. How did you know?
Just a hunch.
Anyway, take that away with you and have a look. I get 25% off sickles weekly if I sign up a friend.
I wouldn't have thought there was enough news for a weekly sickle-based publication, Brian.
Do you own a sickle, pal?
No.
Well, maybe you should keep your opinion to yourself. No, I'm just messing with you. I'll tell you a funny thing about sickles, right? There used to be a right good sickle shop just outside Bradford town. Beautiful handmade stuff, you know. Real old-fashioned craftsmanship. Pricey, like. But it'd slit a child's throat as soon as look at it. That's just a phrase, by the way. It's no serious test of a sickle's quality. Anymore. He went out of business 5 years ago. Just weren't trade, he said. And all the sickles now, you'll never guess where they come from.
Brazil?
No. Korea.
South Korea produces sickles?
Who said South? No, pal. Pyongyang Sickle Company. It accounts for 19% of their GDP. Slip them out disguised as boomerangs, they do. Cheap as you like. Pile of shite, of course. I got one last year and chipped it on first bit of mistletoe I tried to cut. Ironic, that, don't you think?
What's that?
Bunch of commies can't make a sickle. It's like being hit by an ambulance. Driven by Trotsky. Anyway, come and have a look at this beauty. The Wood Dweller Pro, Mark III. That's what that is. Now, I bought this in Germany off a chap in the Brauhaus. Nice bloke. Speaking of which, if you ever need a dragon, just let me know.
Brian kindly agreed to me accompanying him to one of the circle's meetings. Once a month, the group come together to worship the world spirit and perform ancient magic rites at a sacred grove located just off Junction 35 of the M1, not far past the Little Chef. With Charlie's replacement in tow, and after clearing up a misunderstanding with some local doggers, we proceeded to the grove.
Listen, pal. Now that we're here, you should call me by my druidic name.
Okay, yeah, sure. What is it?
Brian Parker.
Isn't that just your name, Brian?
It is. But druids, they're a very formal bunch. Just follow my lead, you'll be fine.
Okay, yeah. But is it absolutely necessary for me to remove my trousers? I mean, you haven't.
We have our ways, and you have yours. But you're at a druid meeting now, so loose the cords. There, Margaret. Not to worry about. Yet. Hail, Magic Bob! Brian Parker, Seer of the Light, greets thee.
Hail, Brian Parker. Magic Bob, follower of the woodland ways and sometime greyhound trainer, salutes thee beneath Our Lady the Moon. You all right, Brian? How's life?
Oh, no complaints.
That you haven't heard before. And who's this lovely lady?
This is Margaret. Say hello to Magic Bob, Margaret.
She's a bit shy.
Yeah, well, so would you be, pal, if you're about to have your ears blown off. Besides, I don't speak goat. Wilfred used to. It were handy, you know, to have a translator. Calmed him down before it told... Where's Sally? She's bringing sandwiches, right?
I hope so. I've been so busy all day working up Philosopher's Stone that I haven't had time to eat nout.
Do you mean the Philosopher's Stone of Myth, Bob?
It ain't no myth, that lad. It's one of the best-selling children's books of all time. There's bare dollar in that, I tell thee. And that J.K. Rowling, she can spin a yarn or two at no mistake.
Bob's been learning to read a late, haven't you, Bob?
True. Ain't ashamed to say it.
Oh, yes, Sally. And she's brought Wilfred. Shut up, Wilfred. Hi, Sally. You're right.
I will be once Wilfred here calms down. Honestly, it's like dogs possessed. Hey, Brian, I've got them things you wanted for your holiday.
Thanks, Sally. Appreciate it.
Who's this, then? And where's his trousers?
I'm making a programme about Brian for Radio 4. He said I shouldn't wear them.
Oh, did he now? And did he also tell you he had to go through wedding ceremony without their goat so she'd be ready?
Yeah. How did you know?
Just a little joke, pal. Should have seen your face. Actually, I've got photos on my phone, haven't I? I can show you. Luke, you're a very lucky man.
Well, you weren't first and you weren't bit last.
No.
I weren't talking to you, Petal. I was talking to your wife.
You speak goat, Sally.
Got you again. For a reporter, you're not all that sharp, pal. Oh, look, here's another keeper.
You're right, Bob. How's Philosopher's Stone?
Page 33.
Wow, coming along then.
Aye, 2 pages today.
Well, can't stand around chatting all evening. Let's get started. Come on, Margaret.
Brian explained how all druid meetings began with the invocation, a ceremonial opening to welcome in the world spirit.
It's an ancient poem of great magical power. No one knows where it comes from. No one even really knows what it means.
This was the first time a druid invocation had ever been recorded.
T'was Brillig and the slithy toad did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves and the mome rats outgrabe. Beware, Jabberwock, me son, jaws that bite snicker snack through and through, and you rather, how's your father?
Although what followed that evening on the South Yorkshire moors was recorded as part of this programme, legal advice has made it quite clear that it should not be broadcast. For personal reasons too, I have chosen to omit it from the programme. All I will say is this. Sarah, darling, I'm sorry. I sincerely regret my actions of that night and admit they were depraved and degrading. If you confide it in your heart to forgive me, I will do all I can to earn your love once more. Please kiss the children for me. And yes, I have bleached my sordid mouth. I can taste nothing but my own betrayal. Two days later, I met Sally once more in a local cafe. We began by discussing what had happened at the Grove.
You had a powerful magical experience, Petal. You sang with world spirit. It changes a man. You've been chosen, marked.
Yeah, I have developed a bit of a rash. Is that...
common? Yeah.
Yeah, it feels it. I asked Sally about being the only witch in a circle of druids.
I ain't a witch, Flower. Don't let that fool you. I'm a druid just like boys.
Oh, sorry, I didn't realise.
There's been a lot of changes in druidism over the last 50 years. And we've had a bigger influence than you know. Women's lib, that started with us. They try to distance themselves now, of course, them feminists. Say it's disreputable. Farcical even. Well, I remember when idea of equal pay for women were as silly as salamander jam. And look where we are today. Women still earning less but pagan condiments on every aisle of Waitrose. Inherently anti-patriarchal is magic. What with world spirit being a lady and all. And some of big names started off in paganism. Why do you think Jermaine Greer's always being called a witch? She won't tell you now, but she used to be High Priestess of a Coven down Sydney way. Anyway, it were us who were the first organisation in Britain to fully embrace equal rights, and it's not a boys' club anymore.
Oh, so it's a bit like the Scouts then?
Yeah, but with less human sacrifice.
Right. And you work in a pharmacy, don't you, Sally?
Yeah, I do. It's nice. I like it. It's mainly giving out lollipops to kiddies and antidepressants to the parents.
And you don't see a contradiction between your work and your faith?
Not really, no. It's all about helping folk at end of day. It don't really matter how you do it. It might be antibiotic, it might be a potion made from newt fingers. As long as you're all getting by and feel at home in the world, that's the main thing, innit? My mum always used to say, they can have as much science as they likes, but if they don't look after their soul, they're never going to be happy. I miss her, I do.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Still, she died doing what she loved.
What was that?
Worshipping Thor. Under oak trees during lightning storms.
And what was it that you gave Brian the other evening, Sally? It sounded like some sort of medicine.
Oh, just a little summer for his holiday. Helping with journey.
Well, like travel sickness pills?
Yeah. If you like.
As our time together drew to a close, I noticed that Brian was becoming more introspective and would repeatedly draw the conversation back to questions of his beliefs and their connection to the world.
Do you ever wonder why you're here at all? As a druid write, I feel a deep connection to the world and to the land. I hear it speaking to me, you know, in the whisper of the leaves like and the bellow of the wind. I feel its pulse beneath my feet as I walk on the soil, but I do not feel part of it. We are cut out, pal, withdrawn from the song of the world spirit. We are not one as we should be, as we were, before time-like. Instead, we work in call centres and discuss X-Factor with Janine over Jaffa cakes at break time. Do you ever get the feeling you've been living someone else's life?
Sometimes, yeah. It's been very difficult at home the past few days. Things have changed since.
I need a change, pal. I need to feel it again. The oneness. That's why I'm going on holiday, isn't it? Get back to who I am. Who I'm meant to be.
That was the last conversation I had with Brian. The next day I returned to my family in London, while he, so far as I knew, departed for his holiday. It was not until 3 days later, when I received a letter from Magic Bob, which was in all honesty very difficult to understand, that I discovered the truth. I returned to Tinsley immediately. Magic Bob had agreed to meet me at Big Karen's Bacon Shack, just off Junction 34. Over a bellybuster big boy breakfast, he explained that Brian had transcended. And what exactly does that mean, Bob?
You know, he's gone.
Yeah, but where?
Back, like... transcended. It's a great honour. Only a few druids have ever done it. Rejoined the world spirit. Are you eating that fried bread, pal?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, I don't understand.
It's like Albus Dumbledore told me.
To a well-organised mind, Death ain't nought but the next great adventure. Very wise man, that Dumbledore. A great druid.
Are you saying Brian is... You do know that Albus Dumbledore's a fictional character, right?
You shouldn't be saying things like that, pal. It ain't nice to say things like that. Knew I shouldn't have bought that bloody owl.
I called Sally to try to talk to her, but there was no answer. Do you know where she is?
She's gone too.
What, she's transcended as well?
No, she's gone magaluf. Gone on holiday. Said something about legal jurisdiction and aiding and abetting and left in an hurry. She sent me a lovely postcard, though.
After a kilo of tiffin and 2 pints of tea, Magic Bob agreed to take me once more to the Sacred Grove so that I could, in his words, see Brian again. It's an overcast and uninspiring day in South Yorkshire. The wind is cruel and the light is beginning to fade. I didn't know Brian all that well, and in all honesty, I don't know what to make of what I see before me now. A grand oak, a centuries-old towers above us, both intimidating and welcoming. It's decorated with ivy and flowers. And around us, on the ground, a stone circle, older, so I'm told, than men remember. And in the centre, proud, defiant almost, a fresh pile of earth. And a new type of holiday.
Unusual Lives was an unbelievable production for BBC Radio 4. The presenter was Sebastian Loxwood and the producer Joshua Barley. And next week on Unusual Lives, we meet Ed, an ambitious young man from London, struggling to balance the competing pulls of his two very different careers, as highly successful female drag artist Eva and as the less well-regarded leader of Her Majesty's opposition. Also coming up later, after the news, we'll have The Archers, in which Emma eats some toast. That's followed by a Moneybox Live special. We join Paul Lewis, his guest panel, and an audience in Hull to ask, the North, where did it all go wrong? But first, all this week on Radio 4, we've been exploring how the current economic crisis is affecting Britain's romantic poet community. Today, on Romantics in Recession, Theo Ensworth talks to romantic poet John Keats about his recent experience of redundancy, his encounters at the Job Centre, and the difficulties facing young writers of 19th century English nature poetry in today's Britain. I'm standing on the wooded banks of the River Thames on a beautiful and delicate sunlit evening. Around me, the dusk chorus of songbirds is just beginning to warm up, and the calmness of the river's current has a wonderful and somnambulant softness to it. It's precisely the sort of place you would expect to find a romantic poet busy at work. But in the current economic environment, making a living from such labour has become increasingly unviable, with some estimates putting the unemployment figure of Britain's romantic poet community as high as 95%. Well, I'm here now with a young man who has experienced firsthand the impact of that figure, the poet John Keats. John, what does this place mean to you now that you're unemployed?
It's quite painful, really. I had to stop coming here since I lost my job as a romantic poet. It's difficult, you know, because the other poets, they still come here to expose themselves to the grace of nature's beauty, but I just don't feel like I have the right anymore.
Yes, I think I can see Shelley just over the other side of the river lying prostrate in the sunlight. He seems to be very busy, just sighing deeply and looking wistfully into the middle distance. Is that the sort of thing you would do when working?
Yeah. Yeah. Percy and I would spend the whole days just simply being, you know, on the grass and under the sky. But it's not the same now. I feel like an imposter.
Shall I call him?
No, there's no need.
He's only over there.
Yeah, but he...
Excuse me, Mr. Shelley.
Doesn't want to see.
Oh, he's just walked away. Do you think I startled him?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, how do you spend your days, John, now that you're unemployed?
I just lie about at home, usually.
Writing?
No.
It's no secret, of course, that more and more people are losing their jobs in these troubled economic times. And poets have certainly not been immune to the waves of redundancies currently sweeping the more traditional industries. A passerby in any one of Britain's major cities will have seen the swelling ranks of out-of-work novelists, composers, and conceptual performance artists who can increasingly be seen congregating in underpasses and parks. Visiting John at his home, I asked him how being unemployed has affected his sense of identity.
I just feel like I've lost my sense of direction.
How do you mean?
Well, before I would just wander, perhaps following a lonely cloud. But now I can walk for hours, but I don't seem to actually get anywhere.
A lonely cloud, that's Wordsworth, isn't it?
No.
I'm sure it's Wordsworth. I wandered lonely as a cloud. We're standing in John's front room now. He's had to sell a lot of his possessions recently, so there's a space where the TV presumably went, John.
Yeah, it was a plasma one that Byron didn't want anymore.
And a space for the radio and computer and a couple of disused data points. In fact, all that remains are just piles and piles of books. It's a very sad sight.
Here's your tea, Theo.
Oh, thanks, John.
You did say sugar, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. John, tell me about your recent interview at the job centre.
The lady, Sharon, she asked me if I had any transferable skills.
And what did you say?
I told her that I could convey the immediate delicacy of nature through language, and that I used to write poems of such beauty that their grace has provided succour to successive generations of poets and readers, and that I achieved all this before the age of 25.
And what did she say?
She asked me if I had a European computer driving license.
And do you?
No. Then she said that there was a vacancy at the Greggs in town and that she thought I had a really good chance of becoming a junior team member, specialising in cooling and glazing.
And how did you feel about that?
I said I hadn't really pictured myself working in Greggs, and did she have anything that involved blossom or nightingales?
What happened?
She said that under the contract I'd signed, I was legally obliged to attend the interview or my benefits could be withdrawn. And then she smiled. So I went along in the end to the interview, because, after all, truth's beauty, isn't it? And truth's everywhere, right? Even in Greggs.
Is it?
No.
But you got the job, didn't you?
Yeah.
And how are you getting on?
I've learnt that although it is important to be able to fall into a rapture at the song of a nightingale or the coming of autumn, in some ways it's more important not to burn the sausage rolls.
Hello, Mrs. Keats. Is John in?
He is, love. He's playing in his room. Do come in.
Thank you.
Can I get you anything?
No, thank you. Since losing his job, John told me that he has begun to suffer from depression and anxiety, and that he counters this by drinking more than usual and eating unhealthily. I went to visit him one Thursday morning at his mother's house, where he'd been staying for a few days. I found him sitting in the corner of his bedroom, eating a packet of crisps.
Here's the thing about beauty. It's a joy forever, you know. It's, loveliness. Theo! It's loveliness increases and shall never pass into nothingness. Well, that's bollocks, isn't it? Just look at my monster munch. They've just passed right into nothingness. Theo? Have you got any munch on you?
No. Sorry, John.
Oh. Can I borrow 50p?
Hi, boys. I've just brought you up some squash and biscuits in case you're thirsty.
Thanks, Mrs. Keats.
What are you boys playing?
Mum?
We're just making a documentary for Radio 4, Mrs. Keats.
Oh, that's nice. I'll let you get on with it then.
Thanks for the squash.
You're welcome, Theo. It's very nice for John to have a friend round, that's all.
Mum?
Oh, before I forget, Pudding, Fanny called. She said, you left your coat at hers, so she's just coming over now to drop it off.
But we're going out.
Well, then you'll need your coat, won't you? He's got bad lungs, Theo. He probably hasn't told you that. Anyway, she won't be long, and I thought she might like to be part of your little programme.
Oh, well, of course you can.
No, we have to go. Tell her I'll see her later.
John and I had left to attend his weekly NHS counselling session, a service which itself has suffered from recent cutbacks, resulting, critics say, in a negative impact on the service provided. John very kindly allowed us to record his session with his counsellor, Malcolm.
And how are you feeling today, John?
A bit down, really.
So pretty normal then, you know, looking on the bright side of things, like we talked about, you know, don't let the bastards get you down and all that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose.
I'll put no change then, shall I?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'll see you next week.
And how did you feel that went, John?
Yeah, it was pretty normal, really. That's usually how it goes.
Do you feel any better, having had a chance to talk through your feelings?
Not really. I don't really feel like I had an opportunity to...
Go on, John, I just have to take this. Hello?
Like, absolutely no one I can talk to about all this, and no one takes my sorrow seriously, because they think he's just a romantic poet. They're meant to be miserable, aren't they?
Sorry, John, what was that?
I was just saying that no one takes my sorrow seriously, because they just think I'm being poetic.
Well, maybe it will be better next week, John.
Yeah, maybe.
Shall we go and get you some Monster Munch?
Yeah, I'd like that.
Well, my last boyfriend was a builder, you know, but I thought I'd try something a little different.
Keats's girlfriend, Fanny, whom I met later that afternoon.
So, when I met Johnny, I thought I'd give him a go. A poet-like, you know, exotic. He's like my little bird. My really miserable little bird.
How did you meet?
My girlfriend Sarah. Her little sister's boyfriend's mate used to go out with Lord Byron. Total knob, she says he was. Right little perv. Anyway, one night Sarah says, do you want to go to a poetry reading? I thought she was joking at first, you know, like poetry. But I was a bit emo at the time, so I went along. I thought it was all romantic. You know what I mean? Like, serious. Deep. But really, he's just miserable.
Isn't it exciting to think that you could inspire his poetry, though?
All right, chill out, Guardian. If he ever came near me, he might write something, but he don't. No, he only writes poems for things with leaves on them. or the moon.
So you're having difficulties then?
He is, sure, but I'm an optimist myself. Besides, I like it here. Mm. Just me and Joe most of the time, ain't it, Joe?
It is.
I usually pop in about 11 and have a cuppa and a ciggy before going down Lord Nelson.
Me too.
Just telling the man that it's pretty much just me and you now, Joan. Joan?
Mm, that's nice, dear.
Hard of hearing. But she ain't any trouble. We play bingo, don't we, Joan?
Mm, we do.
Though she's not very good. She's always losing, aren't you, Joan?
It's me eyesight, love.
And her hearing. Mm. I said, can I borrow that tenner now, Joan? For me ciggies. Mm.
Oh, yes. In the purse, dear.
No, it's empty, Joan.
Oh, is it?
You must have spent it.
Oh, have I? All right, then. I'll just pop upstairs.
She's a sweetie, really. She does need a bit of looking after. And money goes missing quite easily, you know?
Yeah.
Here you go, Puppet.
Ta. Do you want me to pick up your pension while I'm out? Save you the trouble.
Oh, that would be lovely, Fanny. Thank you.
Just need your bank book then, Joan. In the drawer, is it?
All right.
A few days later, I visited John once more at his mother's home. And how is your mental health at the moment, John? I know you've been quite unhappy of late.
Yeah, I just feel like I've lost all confidence, really. Kind of like I'm just really full of doubt. Nothing's certain anymore, and I feel a bit like I'm losing control of who I am.
Haven't you written about that, though, John, in your letters?
What do you mean?
Well, in one of your letters, you write about how you recently felt
that... How did you get that?
Well, they've been published, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. That paid for my Xbox Live account.
And in one of them, you write... I have it here, actually. I mean negative capability. That is when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason.
Why would... Why'd you bring that up, Theo? You promised you wouldn't mention the letters. We had an agreement.
I just thought you might like an opportunity to comment, John.
No. I've got nothing more to say. This interview's over.
I met John for the last time 2 days later in a cafe where he had agreed to meet me to discuss his current work as a spoken word poet. He seemed tense. John, you've been trying to make some money by republishing your work for a modern audience. How's that going?
It's hard to say, really. I found that I was having to make quite a lot of changes that I wasn't really very happy with. I thought I could just put my old poems on the iPhone with an app or something, but when I talked to my publisher, he didn't seem to think it was a very good idea.
And why is that?
He said, 'cause he'd already downloaded them for free and that other people would do the same if they ever read them. Which they didn't.
And can we hear one of your poems adapted for a modern audience?
I'm not sure.
We can always edit it out later, John, if it's not suitable.
Right, okay. A ting of beauty...
I'm sorry?
A ting. You know, like a thing.
Oh, I see. Carry on.
A ting of beauty is a really big gold watch around your neck, and it will never pass into nothingness, mostly because of the fluorescent diamonds which encrust it in an ostentatious and crass manner.
Yes, it's it's lost something, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Don't worry, we'll edit the laughter out. So, you're not particularly enjoying being a spoken word poet?
Being a spoken word poet is very different to being a romantic poet. People think that just because they've both got the word poet in them that they're the same, but they're not.
How so?
Well, poets, like romantic poets, reflect the world back to us in language, providing a prism through which to refract and analyse our own existence. a conversation across centuries and empires to prove that really we're all the same and that when we're gone, all that's left of us is simply love.
Unspoken word poets?
Well, they just rhyme, don't they?
Romantics in Recession was a gainfully unemployed production for Radio 4. The reporter was Theo Ensworth and the producer Quentin Summersbean. And next week at the same time you can hear Radio 4's investigation into the impact of the recession on the price of residential care for the elderly. That's out of house and into a home. But before that, we present the hyperlocal shipping forecast, this week for the city of Sheffield.
Meadow Hall to Carbrook. Wallet emptying rapidly. Carbrook to Brightside. Supermarket trolleys sinking slowly. Brightside to Don Valley. Stadium filling gradually. Don Valley to Attercliffe. Mainly sex shops and massage parlours rising rapidly. Attercliffe to Wicker. Mostly derelict. Some car showrooms 5 miles. Wicker to Canal Basin. Mainly kebab shops and curry houses. Wind rising. Canal Basin to Neep's End. Traffic clearing slowly. Neep's End to Owleton. Real ale. Good. Owleton to Hillsborough. Owls playing badly, gearing down. And that is the end of the shipping forecast.
Later today on Radio 4, Mark Lawson presents a front row special examining the declining fortunes of the blockbuster action movie from the genre's heyday in the mid-90s with films such as Under Siege, Under Siege 2 and Executive Decision to its current doldrums. Mark talks to directors, writers and the stars themselves to find out where it all went wrong. That's a front row special, Close But No Seagull, at 7:15. And that's followed by At Wit's End, Radio 4's latest attempt at comedy. But coming up next, Penelope Finley continues her transition from lightweight celebrity journalist to hard-hitting social news reporter, with her ongoing series on the surprising politics of some of children's television's best-loved shows.
In the summer of 1977... a group of young left-wing BBC writers and producers came together to create a now-forgotten classic. Combining the endearing animation of other children's programming of the period, such as The Magic Roundabout and Noggin' the Nog, with an unremitting Marxist-Leninist analysis of capitalist power structures, Consumole Kids became an instant classic, but one that is now largely omitted in reviews of the broadcasts of the period. Its makers say due to political reasons, others that the original tapes were lost. But whatever the truth, with newly recovered footage and interviews with those behind the programme, today Archive on 4 examines the origins, impact and legacy of this forgotten classic of children's television.
Politically harmonious sunlit morning in the People's Soviet Socialist Republic. But Sammy the Socialist was not happy because Baron von Moneybags had stolen his porridge.
Well, I suppose the first thing you remember, of course, is the theme music. I used to put my children down in front of the television every Tuesday and they would love it, just love it.
The show's writer, Terry White.
You can ask them today, they still know all the words, even if they are in Russian. We were criticised for using the whole 3 minutes for the theme, but we learned quite early on that if you had a theme for 3 minutes, then I could write an awful lot less story in, and that made things a hell of a lot easier.
We did receive criticism for using the Soviet anthem from the time of Joseph Stalin as the theme to a children's television programme, yes.
John Ashworth, puppet maker and chief puppeteer.
But I've always thought of those criticisms as overtly political, so I've never lost any sleep over them.
reuniting producer Leonard Gardner, puppeteer John Ashworth, and writer Terry White, for the first time in 30 years, they told me how the show began.
Well, the idea originally came from a project of John's, actually.
Leonard Gardner.
He had been trying, unsuccessfully as it turned out, to manage an all-girl pop group with a Leninist philosophy. They were the first real pioneers of social realist disco. What were they called again, John?
The Apparatchiks. We actually reached number 5 with our first single, Brezhnev Bebop, but unfortunately we were unable to utilise any of the proceeds of the record sales, tainted as they were by the stench of free market capitalism. A socialist colleague helped us out with some airtime on Radio 1 for our follow-up single, Material Dialectic Girl. But it's very hard for a Marxist pop group to survive outside of a communist economy.
Like a fish out of water?
Yes. If that fish were Trotsky.
The Apparatchiks comprised John's 15-year-old daughter, Vladimir, and 4 of her school-age friends.
I would have to say that they were more innocent times back then. It was a lot more relaxed. For example, when we went on tour, it was just me, a band of pubescent girls and a camper van for 2 weeks. There wasn't any of this hysteria about paedophilia like there is nowadays. Which made it a lot easier.
Made what a lot easier?
Never mind.
But the idea for the show sort of sprung out of that, really.
Writer, Terry White.
A show for children, mixing bright colours, even more colourful characters, and Marx's notion of historical materialism.
Despite disappointing ratings for the first episodes, Komsomol Kids soon became the most popular children's television programme in Britain, to such an extent that Leonard Gardner, in an interview at the time, said that the show had dicked all over Andy Pandy, comments he has since apologised for. But with great success came greater scrutiny of the show and its makers, particularly its hardline Stalinism. I questioned Terry White about the teens' political allegiances at the time. Is it true that in the office there was a collected works of Stalin on the top shelf?
No, that's not true, no. It was on the windowsill. We also had a collected Lenin at one point, but it was purged. Recycled.
Talking to puppet maker John Ashworth, I put to him the accusation that the programme's makers were latter-day examples of Stalin's useful idiots.
I don't think there was anything particularly useful about it. We were just making a children's television show. It wasn't particularly useful. Not in the Marxist sense of the word, anyway.
With discontent rising almost as fast as the viewing figures, the BBC came under vigorous criticism and faced calls to take the show off air. Detractors pointed to political oppression in the USSR, most famously Conservative MP Thomas Witless Murdoch Dacre, who gave a speech in Parliament decrying the BBC as...
The British Army, the KGB, Brezhnev's Broadcast Corporation, an affront to the free peoples of the West, who turn to their media organisations not for propaganda, but to look at tits.
Order! Members must come to order!
Controversially, the team dealt with the issue head-on in the now-infamous episode, Class Traitors and Cake. Leonard Gardner.
Well, we'd all become aware of opinions from certain quarters expressing, shall we say, discontent with certain aspects of the Soviet programme. And they would peddle all the usual myths about state torture, orchestrated famine, mass deportations, and all those other fairy tales. We felt it was important to show a defence of the motherland, and how, in the attainment of world socialism, sacrifices did have to be made. Now, yes, you might say those sacrifices were the fingernails and cigarette-disfigured faces of ordinary Soviet citizens, accused only of the vaguest thought crimes by a system reliant upon terror to instill conformity. But we do at least agree, therefore, that sacrifices were made.
In Class Traitors and Cake, Sammy the Socialist bakes a delicious Lenin drizzle cake for Polly, leaving it on her doorstep. When he returns the next day to find all the cake has been eaten, but not one member of the village Soviet has had a piece, he denounces Polly as a class traitor. Despite at first denying any knowledge of the incident, under interrogation, Polly confesses her crimes, before publicly thanking the KGB agent for her re-education. It was the torture scene, shown at 4:15 in the afternoon, that prompted a public outcry.
I do regret looking back some aspects of how we approached that episode.
John Ashworth.
But I think I, for one, certainly got so caught up in the challenge of accurately representing the female genitalia after electrodes have been applied, using only the traditional puppet-making mediums of felt and chicken wire, that I think in the excitement of it all, we lost sight of the bigger picture, which was to show the human face of the KGB.
Oh, what you have to remember, of course, about class traitors and cake.
Terry White.
Is that as we learned at the end of the episode, Polly didn't eat the cake after all. It was Baron von Moneybags. But Polly's sacrifice wasn't for nothing, as she made an excellent example to all the other citizens. I mean puppets.
Even though she hadn't done anything wrong.
Well, that's not really relevant, is it? I mean, the fact is, justice was seen to be done.
Brutally.
Yes.
The show's sympathetic portrayal of the KGB to a target audience of under-10s wasn't the only element that created controversy. Komsomol Kids also came in for criticism from feminist writers, otherwise sympathetic to the show's broader political message, who argued that the programme showed women to be culturally and legally inferior to their male counterparts, for example in this extract from the episode Wedding Cake, in which Polly and Sam are married.
What's that, Polly? Within the terms of your marriage contract, you have no recourse to a legal concept of rape. Even if your husband forces intercourse upon you against your will. Well, it's a good thing those are awfully big words to understand for a pretty little thing like you, isn't it? That's right. Now, wipe the tears from off that lovely dress, cover up those bruises with some long sleeves, and pop along back to the kitchen. There's a good girl.
I put the comments of Maureen Clark, professor of pro-Soviet British children's television 1970 to 1970, from the University of Dorking to producer Leonard Gardner. Leonard, Clark calls attention to the ineffectual passive nature of the Polly character, arguing that, in unquestioningly championing the Russian machismo identity, Komsomol Kids left entirely unchallenged the inequalities of power inherent to sexual relationships in a patriarchal socialist system. What would you say to that?
I would say that it's a very insightful comment. For a woman. Look, were there elements to the programme that we would change now? Yes, begrudgingly. But it's a product of its time and you have to accommodate for that.
Even the episode where Socialist Sam starts drinking at 7 a.m, throws up in a park at 11 a.m, sleeps through the afternoon on a bench and returns home to beat Polly brutally before passing out with a bottle of vodka.
Oh, you mean the episode Holiday? Well, like I say, we'd make some changes if we made it today. Probably start with the title.
Komsomol Kids also faced accusations of anti-Semitism, something the show's writer, Terry White, passionately disputes.
Look, if it's anti-Semitic to have your one Jewish character found guilty of a bourgeois Zionist conspiracy against the party and the people of the United Soviet Socialist Republics and executed by firing squad before being flung into an unmarked grave in Siberia, then fine, Komsomol Kids was anti-Semitic. But if not, then I really don't see what all the fuss was about.
So it was then?
Oh yes, almost certainly.
Despite, or perhaps because of its immense popularity, the BBC decided not to recommission a second series. With political pressure around left-wing militantism growing and the winter of discontent only months away, Komsomol Kids, with its unapologetic calls to the nation's children to rise up in a total and violent overthrow of Britain's capitalist system, apparently proved too contentious, something Leonard Gardner disputes.
You want to know the real reason they pulled us? I'll tell you, it was Brezhnev. He fucked us. Apparently he was an absolute nut for noggin' the nog, and a mole of the beeb had let it be known back in Moscow that it was either us or that Viking bastard that was going to be recommissioned. So he twanged on one or two of his strings high up in children's television, and what do you know, we got the chop.
But despite its short life on air, Komsomol Kids has had an influence on children's television far greater than its six episodes would suggest, with many commentators linking the October Revolution episode of In the Night Garden directly to the influence of Komsomol Kids. And even individual characters have had successful afterlives, most notably Lenin the Hamster, who embarked almost immediately upon a solo pop career. John Ashworth.
He's probably best remembered nowadays for his 1977 Christmas number one, Stairway to Lenin. But it would be a mistake to omit his other work from any serious review, including his avant-garde reinterpretation of Pink Floyd's Money. 6 minutes, 22 seconds of silence. Each moment in time representing a socialist world untainted by bourgeois commerce. And that's not to forget his cover of Midnight Train to Georgia. Although in this case the Georgia in question was the country, and the train was actually going to Gori, birthplace of Stalin.
And what of the makers of the programme? What are they doing now? And have their political views changed? Terry White stopped writing for television in 1981 in order to become a full-time revolutionary. After spending the 1990s gun-running for the FARC in Colombia, he retired in 2004 to Yorkshire. Despite the democratic revolutions of the last 30 years, he remains defiant about the future of communism.
Well, I suppose it all depends on what you mean by failure, really. I mean, if you count the fall of the Berlin Wall as the failure of communism, then I suppose it would be possible to conclude that Marx got it wrong. But I think you'll find that me and the chaps at Tinsley Communist Party and Bowling Club would disagree.
Leonard Gardner continued to work for the BBC until the early 1990s, but says he considers his greatest achievement to be victory in the Best Lawn in Britain competition, 1986. He attributes success to his unorthodox gardening techniques, applying the economic theory of Friedrich Engels to grass management. About Marxism more generally, however, he is now less dogmatic.
I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and communism was by no means the biggest, as I was saying to my wife just the other day.
And John Ashworth.
Well, I've lived alone since the death of my mother. But I do have a lot of friends, so I don't feel particularly lonely. Yes, they are puppets. But in many ways, I've come to the conclusion that true communism can only really be achieved with puppets. As soon as you introduced real-life people, I find it becomes very hard for them not to laugh at your moustache. And the vast majority of them will refuse to refer to you as Stalin.
Komsomol Kids was a made-up production for Radio 4. The presenter was Penny Wax and the producer, Vladimir Ashworth. And next week you can hear Penny's investigation into the surprising political subtext of another classic of children's television. That's When Paddington Met Pinochet, at the same time next week. Alternatively, you can still listen to last week's show, Bagpuss, Hitler and Me, on BBC iPlayer. Radio 4's twice-weekly look at the world of technology continues in half an hour, when Rita Robinson interviews James Winthrop, inventor of the flat-screen microwave. That's tomorrow, today, today and tomorrow, at 3:30. But before that, on Radio 4, our new series challenging BBC presenters to try something new. This week, John Humphreys talks about his experience of colonic irrigation in I Didn't Know I Had It In Me. Please note, this show is also available with subtitles for those hard of thinking.
You have been listening to Radio 4, written and directed by Lawrence Peacock and produced and edited by Peter Beeston for Basic FM. It featured the voices of David Ott, Lawrence Peacock, Ian Carter, Chris Bellamy, Phil Mason, Christine Bellamy, Jahan Jeet, Alice Collins and Peter Willington. This production is licensed under a Creative Commons agreement. For more information and for full details of all music played in the show, please visit us online at www.cornucopia-radio.co.uk.